By now, you're getting used to seeing green crosses on stores by the roadside in Oregon, the sign of cannabis sold here. Cannabis, marijuana, pick your term, is legal for recreational use in both states now. Changes have already taken place, and many more are on the way. And one hope is that as legal pot becomes more routine, black markets and environmental damage will disappear or at least lessen. We get a good historical perspective on the growing and selling of cannabis in our part of the world in Nick Johnson's book, Grass Roots, subtitled A History of Cannabis in the American West. Nick Johnson is a journalist and historian with degrees in each field. He freelanced for years, but now lives in Colorado and works as associate editor of the Colorado Encyclopedia Online. Nick Johnson, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Colorado's a good place to be, I guess, if you're covering cannabis these days, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, it was quite a bit of culture shock coming from Illinois out here with that whole the whole pot culture here. But yeah, it's definitely kind of ground zero.
Since Colorado adopted before either Oregon or California, does it seem like it's sort of getting to a smoother point of the road, or do things still change every day?
I think things are still changing. From an environmental standpoint, they certainly did not pay as much attention as Oregon and California, even Washington State. But yeah, they're definitely still trying to figure things out.
So not surprisingly, you begin the book Grassroots with the marijuana versus cannabis terminology. Can you roll out the issues there and why some people insist so strongly not using marijuana?
Sure, because of the history around the word marijuana, it was started becoming in vogue, if you will, in the 1930s when Harry Anslinger was head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and he was very anti-pot, and he put together what he called a gore file of all these newspaper clippings, you know, about people under the influence of marijuana, murdering people, and so forth. And he really connected the term. It was brought out of the Mexican colloquial vocabulary for cannabis. And because at that time, you know, in the early 20th century in the United States, people referred to drug cannabis as cannabis indica, as Indian hemp, other kind of more scientific terms. Marijuana was something that came from Mexico, and it was kind of used to kind of demonize the drug, kind of make it foreign and alien and menacing sounding. And on top of that, you had the practice of smoking it, which was relatively new in the United States at the time. So they were really trying to make this this drug that had been in the country for a long time into a foreign menace. And so that's the connection there. People say that it's a racist term because it was taken out of the Mexican lexicon.
Oh, now it becomes clear. So, you know, it was cannabis here, but the stuff that comes over the border, that's marijuana.
Right, exactly. So you had that. So that's the argument of a lot of folks in the legalization camp or in the pro-cannabis camp. You know, they wanted to get away from that kind of arcane terminology, the old terminology for it. But really, it's not a racist term. In fact, the term marijuana has origins in Africa. It comes from an Angolan term, diamba, which was then carried over to Portuguese, you know, to in Brazil with the Angolan slaves that went there, and the Portuguese started calling it mariamba, and that kind of got dragged through Spanish. And this is all documented by the geographer and cannabis historian Chris Duval. He wrote a great book about cannabis a couple of years ago, and he kind of fleshes out this. He speaks more languages than I do, so he's able to do this kind of, you know, transnational research. And he figured this out, and he traced its origins back to Africa. And you know, it's really not, you know, just for something to be a racist term, it has to refer to a group of people in a disparaging way, you know, like like redskin or something, you know, that. You know, so the term marijuana is not inherently racist. I understand why people would want to stop using it, because it's kind of a term from the Prohibition era. You know, it's been the government speak, you know, for so many years, and the government has just, you know, come down hard on marijuana and cannabis. So I totally understand those who feel that it's an outdated word and, you know, that want to be sensitive to the history of it, especially the racialized history of it, but it's not a racist term.
Chris Duval, obviously, and people who've done some work on the history, you could certainly go and rely on them. But boy, for trying to cover a product that's been illegal for so long in the United States, how difficult was it to come up with reliable information?
It's pretty difficult. I mean, it's a little bit easier now in the age of digitization of, you know, primary sources and all of that. But for the most part, for the book, I relied a lot on newspaper reports. And I tried to kind of take those, especially early 20th century reports, I tried to take them with, you know, a grain of salt. and try to pull out facts that I know that the newspapers wouldn't lie about, or that authorities who are informing the newspapers wouldn't lie about. You know, for instance, where a crop was found, who was growing it, you know, these kind of basic facts about it. And from there, I was kind of able to piece together the rest of the story by kind of, you know, putting the rest of the rhetoric and language in historical context, you know, with things like the idea of the Orient, you know, and it being associated with hashish and compared to opium and all these other tropes that were kind of swirling around the American mindset at that time.
So the first vignette in the book is with Anthony Salvaggio at Humboldt State. Tell us a bit about him and what he's been studying.
Yeah, Anthony is such an interesting guy to talk to. He never minces words, ever. And that's why he was such a great interview subject, because he just tells it like it is. But yeah, he came down to, he lived in Humboldt, he's lived down there since the 90s, and he's had a first-hand experience of the environmental consequences of this. He's basically a member of the Humboldt Institute for Interdisciplinary Marijuana Research. It's a team of academics down at Humboldt State who study all aspects of kind of marijuana culture down there, you know, the social effects, the environmental effects, you know, the public health debates and all that. And he's a sociologist. He's particularly concerned with the environmental effects. And, you know, he's the one who first laid it out for me that, you know, first we had the commercial fishing and the industrial logging, and then the ecosystem started to recover, you know, by the mid-90s. And then you had California legalize the medical use of marijuana, and you had a huge gray market pop up, and of course, ongoing federal prohibition is the main reason for the, you know, it really incentivizes illegal cultivation of cannabis. But that gray market situation really made the whole environmental effects of weed out there very, it exacerbated it.
All right, let's talk more about the incentives damage to the environment here. And just the water needs alone are amazing. 6 gallons of water per plant, so that you do some multiplication, you figure out how much water is in demand here. We'll come back and talk more with Nick Johnson about his book, Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. You can join the conversation by phone or by email. We'll join the Jefferson Exchange once again in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Nick Johnson, journalist and historian. He's written a book looking back more than a few decades, actually into the middle of the 19th century, and in some cases beyond, to the cultivation of cannabis in our part of the world. His book is called Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. Takes it right up to the present day. We were just talking about issues with environmental damage. That's a thread that runs long through the book, the idea that yes, while people are making marijuana, they're also doing bad things to the environment around the marijuana grows. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Nick, let's come back to that point where you said that there basically are incentives then for people to wreck the environment just because they're making so much money?
Right. I mean, the basic incentive is the price. Prohibition just keeps that black market price high. People are growing in California, exporting it all around the country and probably all around the world. It's a region that has an embedded history of cannabis cultivation going back to the 70s, Southern Oregon as well. So this is just kind of that reputation, the regional reputation for growing really attracted a lot of black market growers, plus the remoteness of the region. It's just so difficult to enforce illegal anything out there. I mean, the authorities during Prohibition during alcohol prohibition had a tough time, you know, enforcing illegal stills and all that out there. So it's a combination of factors that has to do with kind of geography of the region, the kind of local history, also the fact that economically there's really not a whole lot else to do in that region. You know, one of the things that stuck out from my interviews in Humboldt County were Salvaggio told me that, you know, if you're not involved in the cannabis industry, if you're not trimming, if you're not, you know, supplying the industry, if you're not growing, you know, people wonder what you're up to, which is kind of an inverse of,
sure,
you know, everywhere else in the country, people, right? It's like, well, as long as you're not growing marijuana, it's like, no, people there are like, if you're not growing weed, what are you doing? You know, you're kind of sketchy.
Why is he not involved in the marijuana business?
Right.
Yeah, well, that's weird. Humboldt County did pass a land use ordinance after your visit with Anthony Salvaggio and some other folks.
Right.
What did they want to do with that land use ordinance about cannabis grows?
Well, they want to regulate things like water use and chemical use and, you know, the amount of acreage, and they want to try to get people to stop clear cutting, and they want to get people to apply for permits, and, you know, that's all well and good. But I think Salvaggio, you know, is, you know, I interviewed him and I have him in the book saying that he's not really convinced that the enforcement is really there for these kind of laws. I mean, there have been things that have been successful in the past. For instance, the Mendocino County zip tie program, which is several years ago, basically said we're going to keep track of all the plants that are going to be grown under California's medical law. We're going to put a zip tie around each one. And we just need, you know, the county went and collected all this information from growers, and growers were very hesitant to provide their information, register for the program, because they didn't want it to get turned over to the feds. And the county said, no, we're not going to turn it over. And what happened was, you know, the feds were, they went through this period where they were okay with, you know, they weren't really pressing the enforcement, and then they decided to press the enforcement and gather information, and so they basically requested all of the information on the growers. And threatened the county, you know, said you're operating in illegal operation in violation of the Controlled Substances Act, and you need to turn over this information. So the county had no choice but to turn over growers' information, and that really turned off a lot of growers to the idea of local regulation. So there's still this specter of federal prohibition that's, you know, lingering over the area and is really likely to throw a lot of, you know, monkey wrenches into any kind of plans to regulate it locally. And then on top of that, as I mentioned, there's the problem with enforcement. You know, you just don't, there's so many growers. I mean, there's more than 10,000 was, you know, the most recent estimate that I'm familiar with. I'm sure it's larger now. But, I mean, how do you police 10,000 growers?
Not easily, obviously. So, yeah. So let's begin the history lesson in the book. How long has cannabis been cultivated in the world? It was interesting because in looking for pictures to help us tell the story on the web, I ran across cannabis growing wild in India, for example.
Yeah, so I mean, thousands of years. If you know, the ancient Chinese were the first among the first civilizations to domesticate cannabis for both both fiber and drug, you know, medicinal use. It was a huge part of Indian culture for thousands of years. I mean, really, cannabis actually has the widest geographic range of any crop, which was something that I found pretty fascinating. The reason is because it's just an incredibly useful plant on so many levels. You know, people use it. You have used it for medicine, for food, for fiber, for seed oil. In the United States, for instance, a big industry in the early 20th century was hemp bird seed, which I discuss in the book. So it has just a wide variety of uses, and over time, it's been, you know, artificially selected in places like India, in particular. They're one of the most prominent cultures to use drug cannabis, you know, spiritually, and they've artificially selected for these, you know, more potent drug strains over time. They're the ones who pioneered the practice of removing the male plants from the crop to, you know, have the females produce bigger and stickier buds and more potent drug product. So that technique has actually kind of traveled the world after that. So it's definitely been around for a very, very long time. Evolutionarily, it originated in Central Asia, both fiber and drug varieties, and this was tens of thousands of years ago. Those both evolved.
Nick Johnson's our guest on The Exchange. His book is Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. I do love the science. What is the assumption that scientists make about why the plants develop these intoxicants?
For drug cannabis, it was a natural sunscreen that the plant evolved to protect its flowers from UV rays. And it evolved in kind of a high elevation area in the Himalayas. And so the thinking is that the plant developed this to protect the flowers from the rays of the sun. And then it also helps to deter insect predation.
Does it have any effect on other mammals? I guess where I got to was wondering why, for example, that people end up using rat poison, which ends up killing fishers in parts of California.
Exactly, there is a wide variety of animal species that would eat it, and that's another purpose of the intoxicating resin. It kind of, you know, dazes and disorients, you know, not only people but also animals. So that's one of the things. And there's actually a theory that humans. This is the botanist Mark Merlin and Robert Clark wrote a book about this, in which they theorized that there were, you know, wildfires that started, and then humans kind of accidentally inhaled the smoke, and they could have even been human set fires as well. And that's kind of how they first discovered the intoxicating properties. But this is theory. I mean, very little of this has been, like, actually pinned down and well documented, and, you know, there's good reasons for that. It was a long time ago, and you've got to go through all these ancient sources and languages, and
right.
You know, so it's definitely tricky work. But the main point is that it's an incredibly complex plant. We're still not even sure how many species there are. This is an ongoing debate in the cannabis science community, whether it's cannabis sativa covers all of it, or whether there's sativa and indica. You know, you go in dispensaries in Colorado, Washington State, Oregon, they tell you, well, this is an indica, this is a sativa, but you know, botanically speaking, no one's really sure. I mean, that terminology developed as kind of a handy way to differentiate between the different effects of the different plants. And we know that there are definitely different, for instance, there's a variety that evolved in mountain climates that, makes you a little bit, sleepier and, makes you a little bit more lethargic, and it's kind of more of a body high, as they say. And then there's, one that's grown more in Mediterranean climates that, gets a little bit more cerebral, makes you a little bit more active and all of that. And so that kind of came out in like the 70s and 80s, distinction between, oh, this is an indica, this is sativa. And both of those terms, by the way, have been used by botanists to describe drug varieties of cannabis in the past. But modern science, for instance, there's a geneticist named John McPartland who did an experiment on purported indica and sativa strains. He basically compared the genetic barcodes of these plants to other plants, other totally different species of plants that are different species, and he found there wasn't enough genetic difference between the different varieties of cannabis as there were with the different species of other plants, and so that didn't really warrant a separate species categorization. So it kind of threw this whole indica sativa nomenclature out the window, but that's not to say that it's not, multiple species. So it's a really interesting debate.
It really is. It ends up almost sounding like dog breeds. It's like, they're all dogs, but,
Right, and so, I struggled with that terminology in the book. What do I call it? At first, when I wrote the first draft, I referred to everything as cannabis indica because I had read some genetic studies that convinced me that, there's probably all drug cannabis is indica and all sativa varieties are, are hemp. But then when I talked to Dr. McPartland, I actually emailed him, I was corresponding with him, and he's got a new book coming out as well. And he basically changed my mind on that. And so I was like, okay, I don't want to get into this whole debate. I don't want to take a side here because that would just distract from the main point of my book, which is that, there are environmental effects of this. So I decided to just, it's all cannabis. That's accurate. And, I used the word, marijuana, and I used the words drug cannabis, to kind of differentiate it. So, but yeah, the terminology aspect is kind of it's a muddy thing, and I wasn't too eager to dive into it.
I can understand that. And the medicine stuff is really interesting because it got quite a list of uses in the United States, like even for things like corns. And then there's a great, you actually have some pictures in here, including the manual, the cover of the manual for the U.S. Department of Agriculture giving instructions for growing cannabis. So it was quite acceptable at one time.
Yeah, and that was actually part of the USDA at the time was thinking, hey, we're importing all of this drug cannabis from England via India. That was the main source of drug cannabis from the United States in the 19th century. And they said, why can't we grow it here? And so as the 20th century rolled around, they started doing these agricultural experiments. And this is an era in which agriculture was becoming increasingly professionalized when, team panels of scientists were kind of dispatched by the government to figure out solutions to agricultural problems. It was really kind of the dawn of a new knowledge system in the United States, and cannabis was one of the, first subjects of this. The USDA had its own plant physiologist in charge, W.W. Stockburger, and he was charged with basically figuring out whether we can grow not only cannabis but also other drug plants here domestically and not have to import them. And then, also wanted to see if American farmers could cash in on this industry. And so what he did was he basically commissioned a bunch of experimental plots of drug cannabis, hot peppers, things like, lavender and ginseng. And there's, it varied depending on the site. And they basically trying to figure out which climates that these plants grew best in and, whether there was a thriving market for the drug that American farmers could tap into. And that was the genesis of this 1915 pamphlet titled Drug Plants Under Cultivation, which includes instructions on how to grow dozens and dozens of drug plants, including drug cannabis. And then by 1920, they actually updated it to include, I mentioned this earlier, it came all the way from India. The government actually figured out that if you remove the male plants from the crop, it would would produce a stronger drug product, and today we call this sensimilla, Spanish for without seeds. But that was actually, the government figured this out in 1920.
Wow.
And, you know, so we have this idea that, you know, the federal government's always been anti-cannabis, anti-marijuana, all this. Here it is in 1915, 1920, circulating instructions on how to grow it. The thing was is that it wasn't, it proved not to be a very popular medicine at the time.
We are talking about cannabis, marijuana. Nick Johnson is a historian and journalist. He wrote a book called Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West, out from Oregon State University Press. You can join us on The Exchange as we talk about the history of the product and what it's become and where it's going in today's world. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you had the support of the USDA then. Here's how to grow this stuff. And then what turned? I mean, what is the larger anti-vice context that led to the banning of marijuana?
Well, there's anti-vice, but I also want to, before I get into that, I also want to point out that it wasn't a very, like I just said, it wasn't a very popular medicine. That's the reason for that is because, like I said, it was the subject of all of these kind of newly maturing disciplines like pharmacology and medicine and all that. And as these, you know, pharmacists were studying it, doctors were studying it, and they could not figure out, you know, an appropriate dosage, you know, for instance. They couldn't nail down exactly what it all helped with, you know, what ailments it helped treat. So they really, there was a lack of a medical consensus about it. And, of course, the most popular painkiller, which is probably what cannabis would have been most effective, you know, obviously, was opium. So at the time, you know, they're like, well, everyone uses opiate products, you know, for these for painkillers, you know, things like laudanum, and this is at toward the end of the 19th century, getting into the 20th, and it wasn't really until you had the Harrison Narcotics Act of 1914 when opium products start becoming more regulated, and that actually ties into, you know, the racial history of prohibition, because of course we know that the anti-opium and the anti-narcotic trend in the United States began when the Chinese began bringing it to California in the mid-19th century, and that kind of just created this anti, it was part of the whole anti-Chinese fervor, and in states like Colorado, you know, in the early 20th century, you know, got by 1917, Colorado outlaws all cultivation of cannabis, and this is really, at the time, you also have temperance going on, so this is a response by certain states like Colorado, like California, like Utah, to kind of limit the spread of vice in general, so to go along with alcohol bans, for instance, which Colorado also banned around the same time. They didn't want people turning to drug cannabis, which was still available in pharmacies, you know, so they kind of wanted to stamp out all of this vice activity. And actually, California was the first state to pass an anti-cannabis state law in 1913.
So when it came to federal law, though, you described the congressional hearings on the so-called Marijuana Tax Act as fact-free. How deep did it get in there?
Well, the underlying assumption of the Tax Act was that all cannabis was or could be marijuana, and that the fact that legislators were blind to the problems that would create is very telling. And they were blind because they were convinced by Anslinger's propaganda campaign, basically. They were convinced by the sensational news reports going around at the time. You know, the marijuana, the whole marijuana story, the reefer madness, if you will, that whole folklore came north from Mexico, and American newspapers seized on it because it was a great way to sell papers. I mean, you've got people running around Mexico City with knives, and stabbing people, you know, and as soon as anything like that happens here, they're just all over it, you know, and that sells a lot of papers. And basically, the Congress people were convinced by all these newspaper reports and by Anslinger, who just kind of organized and you know, was a kind of just a machine for disseminating and re-disseminating these newspaper reports and everything. They were just terrified of this drug, and so they really let the fear kind of creep in, and then that shows up when you have the lone representative of the American Medical Association who testifies. His name is William Woodward at the Tax Act hearings, and he's like, you know, you guys have, you know, we're told that it's being sold to school children. You know, we have no proof of this from any federal agency. We're told that, you know, that there's a problem with the prison, with crime. You know, the Bureau of the Prisons has nothing to say about this. So Woodward's going there, and he's representing the American Medical Association, which was opposed to the Marijuana Tax Act. And he's saying, look, you guys have not considered all the evidence. And they just basically totally blew him off, and they said that he was just jealous because they didn't ask him to help write the bill, because Woodward had earlier helped with the Harrison Narcotics Act. He wrote that, and they were like, you know, you're just pissed off that you're not involved in writing this process. They tried to assassinate his character basically during the hearings, and really it was just all driven by fear.
So you tell the story of a little later in the 20th century, the birds and uninvited cannabis plants in California backyards. What happened there?
So as I mentioned, hemp birdseed was a huge industry in the first half of the 20th century. In fact, the year the Tax Act was passed, Americans bought 4 million pounds of hemp birdseed. And the way that they went about trying to solve this kind of conundrum in the Tax Act hearings was they had representatives from the hemp birdseed industry and the hemp oil industry, and they basically said, we don't want this new law to affect our business. What can you do? And Congress agreed to, well, you have to sterilize all your hemp seed. That should take care of it. I just said 4 million pounds, were sold. So that was not sterilized. And then you have in the decades that followed, you had companies try to sterilize it, but sometimes the sterilization process didn't take. I know that a lot of listeners have seen Jurassic Park, life finds a way, right. Jeff Goldblum kind of laid it out there for us, and that's kind of what happened. So that's the reason you have all these wild hemp plants being distributed all across American lawns in the first half of the 20th century.
Nick Johnson is the author of Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. We'll come back to the conversation, and you can join us by phone or by email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about cannabis, marijuana, pick your term, but Nick Johnson writes extensively about it and its cultivation in our part of the world in his book, Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. It's from Oregon State University Press. You can join the conversation with Nick here on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. And again, a major thread running through the book is the idea that as prohibition deepened, and yet as people realized they could make a lot of money with marijuana, it got grown quietly and illegally and quite environmentally damaging in some places. Were you able to determine, Nick, that when marijuana cultivation, cannabis cultivation was legal, whether it had as big an effect on the environment as it did when it was illegal?
No, and the reason for that is because the American hemp industry peaked in about the mid-1860s. And then it kind of fell off, at least cultivation for fiber purposes. And then drug cannabis, again, was not a very popular medicine. And, the USDA tried to promote its growth, but ultimately there wasn't enough incentive for farmers to grow it. It really wasn't until after prohibition took effect that you have things like the counterculture of the 1960s, which popularized it, that really start to make it more valuable.
Well, I was going to ask you about the counterculture years because there's some interesting figures in there. Johnny Pot, for example.
Yeah, Johnny Pot was basically a traveling hippie who hitchhiked across the country and carried a bag of marijuana seeds in a postal sack over his shoulder, and he just kind of planted a scattering of seeds everywhere he went, and then he would move on. And according to the articles, the Associated Press covered one in 1968. He would draw maps to these plots for his fellow hippies to find the pot plants. So it was just kind of whimsical. It really did kind of embody the counterculture's relationship with weed. It's kind of a whimsical, just throw a bunch of seeds in there. There was no, they weren't cutting, clones off of a mother plant. It wasn't this scientific indoor agriculture that we have today. I thought that was just a fascinating story. And, the fact that, the feds were trying to, chase him everywhere he went is just, to me, it was just laughable because, it's like a garden weed. It's ubiquitous. You're not going to do anything about it. And again, like I mentioned in the previous segment, this kind of stems from this underlying assumption that everywhere cannabis is growing, we have to go get it. We have to go stamp it out or burn it up. And it resulted in a lot of embarrassing episodes for the government and well before the counterculture.
Like what?
Well, for instance, in 1951, there was GIs from Rocky Mountain Arsenal were called out to eradicate a wild hemp patch growing on a vacant lot in Denver. And they actually used military-grade flamethrowers for 2 hours on this thick stand of hemp and other weeds. And they declared it too moist to burn in the end. And so that's just, it's just kind of comical to see, America's enlisted men, being put to this kind of use. You got to think that they had better things to do at that time.
A very energy-intensive sort of eradication project, for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, the burning was something that they always used to do. I mean, there's another example, even from back around the era of the Tax Act, 1938, Red Lodge, Montana, there was a fiber company out there that planted a field of hemp, and the authorities saw it and said, hey, that's marijuana, and they burned it all up, only to find out a week later that it was the fiber company's hemp crop they had burned up. And the mayor of Red Lodge had to go to the newspaper and denounce the whole thing as a big mistake, you know. And yeah, so it definitely produced, you know, from a historian's perspective, it's kind of amusing, you know. So, you know, it's like trying to control dandelions on your front lawn or something. You
know, yeah, and we all know how easy that is.
Yeah.
I realize, Nick, this is not a sociological study, but as you looked at the 60s and the counterculture, I mean, did pot appeal to baby boomers largely because their parents feared it, do you think?
I think in some sense it did, yeah. I think, you know, everything they were being told growing up about it, you know, and then by the time it rolled around to actually experiencing it, they said, well, wow, this is just not like what they're saying it is. And I think that kind of just galvanized them to just kind of bring it into their fold or their culture even more.
So you describe the country communes in the 60s and 70s where pot was grown, and, you know, those communes were about harmony with nature. Was there any direct link between what happened there and what happened later under Prohibition, where people began to grow on a much larger scale and use pesticides and rat poisons and all the other stuff?
I think that kind of environmental ethic that the counterculture had with regards to marijuana was kind of largely thrown out the window as soon as people realized they could make a lot of money by growing it in the late 70s, early 80s. And, you know, Ray Raphael is a historian who writes about Northern California, and he points this out, that with the Back to the Land movement, goes to Northern California, starts growing pot. Initially, it's kind of a cottage industry. They sell to support their homesteads, you know, and pay their land taxes and, you know, just have their own supply. But then they start realizing that, hey, there's a lot of people who like to smoke pot, and not just here, and we can really sell to them in San Francisco, you know, wherever. And then, you know, at that same time, in the 70s, you had the Paraquat Scare, which was basically the United States government helping the Mexican government spray Mexican cannabis crops with paraquat, which is a dangerous herbicide. And everyone who smoked pot in the United States was concerned that their stash was tainted with paraquat, and it was this whole thing. And, you know, it turned out that most of the cannabis was probably fine, that, you know, it killed a lot of the plants before they went to harvest, this kind of thing. But the idea that, you know, foreign cannabis was now not so good, because before, up to that point, you know, homegrown weed, American-grown weed was considered, you know, ditch stuff. You know, it was not good.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the idea that foreign weed is now contaminated, combined with the fact that the counterculture had just popularized weed and there was a huge demand for it, really kind of jump-started the domestic marijuana production, especially in Northern California at the end of the 70s into the 80s.
Is that what really goosed the growth of the industry in the mythical state of Jefferson where we live?
I think it's primarily the popularization of marijuana. I don't think it was 100% the Paraquat Scare. I think it definitely played into that. But I think it's more so there's a huge demand. There's a huge market for marijuana domestically. I mean, the number of pot smokers went, you know, up into the millions in the 70s, and that just had never really... There'd never been that many people smoking pot before in the United States. So, you know, they wanted to get it from somewhere, and... you know, these people who, you know, they were counterculture expats, you know, if you will, they're leaving civilization, quote unquote, to go out into your neck of the woods, into the state of Jefferson, and to kind of grow under the cover of the geography. And they really found a great opportunity to supply this this black market.
Let's reestablish a bit of a timeline here, because Reefer Madness was in what, 1937, and the Marijuana Tax Act was soon after that?
Right, Reefer Madness starts coalescing in the United States after the turn of the 20th century. So it took a couple of decades.
And if you've never seen the movie, it's worth looking up online. It's way over the top and depictions of people who are driven insane by marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, marijuana, yes. They spelled it with an H for a while. Yeah.
So that was 1937. When did the federal government place cannabis on the schedule of drugs?
That was in 1970 with the Controlled Substances Act. Mm-hmm. And that actually the year earlier, the Marijuana Tax Act had been declared unconstitutional in Leary v. United States Supreme Court. And so lacking that, you know, the federal government kind of reorganized federal drug, not just cannabis prohibition, but all federal drug, you know, regulations under this new Controlled Substances Act. Cannabis is placed in Schedule 1, which is reserved for, you know, the most addictive, the most medically useless, you know, according to the definition of Schedule 1. it's right up there with heroin. And so then a couple of years later, you have the creation of the DEA, which is the modern kind of enforcement mechanism for federal prohibition. So that's really when the modern kind of war on drugs kind of gets its legislative and, you know, it's kind of its political footing.
You know, I'm struck by a memory in my own life here, and just how people from people who were alive in the 30s reacted so strongly to any discussion of marijuana. I mean, you know, going to elementary school in the 60s, we were given these little weekly reader handouts to explain what all the drugs were and how they acted on people and why they were bad.
Yeah.
And it said under marijuana, it's not a hallucinogen. And Mrs. Blumenthal had us cross that out, not a hallucinogen. She said, you fly out the window. How is that not a hallucinogen? So the abject fear that marijuana seemed to hold for generations of Americans is way out of whack, it seems, to its actual effect.
And I want to chalk that up to the cryptic nature of the plant. You know, we still don't fully understand it today. You know, we don't know how many species there are of it. We still don't understand, you know, all of the medical potential it has, and there's probably some negative effects that we haven't discovered either. I mean, this is something that, yes, in high doses it can be an hallucinogen, but in most dosages it's not. So people tend to fear what they don't understand, and I think that not understanding, you know, not being able to predict what's going to happen under the influence was a major factor in cannabis's demise as a medicine in the United States and in the continued opposition to its relegalization.
You know, I must admit, I've asked in several interviews the difference between the marijuana that you can use as a drug versus hemp, and then, it's the different sexes of the plant, but it's really not that. Is it just one has less THC than the other, right?
Yeah, and then there's instances of people extracting psychoactive cannabinoids from hemp plants. So there's there's apparently some kind of latent psychoactive properties in hemp, and because that's the only reason that it would explain these earlier experiments, you know, where a doctor is taking, you know, there's, I believe his name was Wood, Dr. Horatio Wood, I believe, in the 1930s, and it may have been in the 19th century, but there's been experiments where they extract, you know, they basically get an extract from what's a hemp plant, and, you know, they have these psychoactive, you know, trips on it. And so that really confused me. That threw me off because I'm like, wait a minute. So there were all these twists and turns as I was doing research where I thought I was sure about what the plant was, and then I wasn't. And then I had to go back and confirm and try to put, you know, context together. So, it's a difficult plant to understand, I will say that. That's definitely how I'd sum it up.
Easier to cover the history of how people use it and cultivate it. And in that vein, one of our regulars showed up in the book. That's Chelsea Rose, an archaeologist from Southern Oregon University. What did you learn from her?
Well, again, like Silvaggio and Humboldt, she's an academic who, you know, she's an archaeologist. She's has a front row seat to the environmental effects of this, and she actually showed me a couple of abandoned growth sites out in Southern Oregon, west of Medford. There are abandoned hoop houses, and there's just plastic coverings all over and just kind of littering the ground of this one hillside. There was a hose that pumped water from a nearby homestead up this hill. And, you know, this is a very thickly forested hill. It's covered with madrone trees and poison oak, and it would be almost impossible to spot these. And they were kind of low hoop houses, probably no more than a few feet high at their highest point. So when that forest was in full growth, it would have been almost impossible to see these sites from the air. And based on their construction and the materials and kind of the condition of them being left, we kind of surmised that they were there since probably the mid-90s. Supposedly, this was in the area where one of the Oregon growers came up with the strain Train Wreck. It's a very popular marijuana strain now. They usually use it as a base to cross it with other different varieties of cannabis. That breeding and growing culture is very embedded there in the hills of Southern Oregon, just like it is in Northern California.
It's just interesting to think of archaeology into pot grows from 20 years ago, but that is in fact what you were up to with Chelsea Rose. So a grow that is born as an illegal operation, does it tend to keep the characteristics of an illegal operation? I mean, do some of these places over time realize, hey, you know, we can come into the sunshine now, or did you find some evidence that places that were hidden stayed hidden?
I think in terms of, I want to go back to Colorado here, but in Colorado's experience, a lot of the state never really questioned the dominant cultivation methods when it legalized after 2012. Just to put this in perspective, the governor put together a task force on the implementation of Amendment 64, which was the ballot initiative that legalized marijuana in Colorado. And he said, you know, you guys, it's your guys' job to come up with a comprehensive report about how we can get this done. How can we implement the will of the voters? And they produced a 166-page report, and they didn't mention the word water once, despite the fact that they're legalizing a crop. And that it's surprising to me because, you know, obviously it's something that grows. But I think, you know, you've got generations of talk of this being an illegal substance, a controlled substance, a manufactured substance, an illegal narcotic, you know, all of these terms that basically don't say anything about agriculture. You know, they don't mean anything, they're not related to agriculture in any way. And I think that was kind of part of it. And then, you know, they didn't do any research, and there was research available out there that would have told them about the energy footprint of indoor growing, for instance, that would have told them about, you know, things like the pesticide issue. And what happened was they have been starting to experience that here in Colorado, and they've been trying to adjust to it. You know, as soon as legalization happened, there was everyone in Denver snapped up all the warehouse spaces here. And they, you know, it's a huge investment. You know, you have to retrofit a warehouse that was used just for storing, you know, crates of goods to a cultivation facility that has to grow plants.
Very environmentally controlled one at that.
Right, yeah, and they didn't think about water use or water regulations or anything like that or pesticide use, and that came back to bite them, you know. So there you go.
All right, recent history and some older stuff as well makes this a really interesting book. It's called Grassroots, A History of Cannabis in the American West. It's from Oregon State University Press. Nick Johnson, historian and journalist, wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Nick, thank you.
Thank you.